Hello, welcome to the Behind the Headlines podcast with me, John Crowley.
And me, Hannah Storm.
In our podcast, journalism colleagues tell us about the stories they've covered and we hear their own stories as well. They share with us why journalism matters to them and what motivates them to keep on bearing witness.
John and I are both directors of Headlines Network and have been involved in journalism for decades. We know journalists aren't robots. They face pressures either because of the stories they cover or the situations they find themselves in, wherever they work. Our industry is adapting to the realisation that it needs to take conversations around well-being more seriously, and it's our hope that these episodes help with that.
For this episode, we are pleased to welcome Leona O'Neill. Leona has been a journalist for almost a quarter of a century. In that time, she has written for the Belfast Telegraph, the Irish News, and worked as a field producer for major international news outlets. Currently a lecturer in journalism at Ulster University, Leona is an advocate for journalism safety and better mental health in newsrooms. Leona, it's great to have you with us. Tell us what made you want to become a journalist and how did you get into the profession?
I've always wanted to be a journalist since I was a little girl. I suppose my dad was very involved in history and politics. He was a history teacher in a local kind of a secondary school in Strabane, actually in County Tyrone. And he was also a leading light in the civil rights movement, which was a peaceful movement for equality here in Northern Ireland. You can imagine that Northern Ireland was a bit dramatic. In the 70s, 80s, 90s, we had the Troubles here, so my dad would have been glued to the television every night watching the news, and I saw people like Kate Eady and other people, you know, reporting from the streets of Belfast, reporting from the streets of Derry, you know, just maybe a mile away from where I was. Chaotic scenes around them, and they're there very cool and calm and collected. I just loved it. I had a real big interest in the news from a very, very young age. And I wanted to be those people. I wanted to be the person who was reporting from the scenes and sort of bearing witness to all this stuff and finding out why it was happening and what was happening and stuff. So yeah, from a little girl, that's what I wanted to be, a journalist. And I suppose growing up in Northern Ireland, there was always news happening. There were always things happening, often very grim and horrible, terrible things happening. But I wasn't put off by that. I wanted to find out why those things were happening. So I trained to be a journalist when I left school and got a job in a local newspaper and worked my way up and eventually, you know, started working in the Irish News and then in later years, Belfast Telegraph and the likes of Al Jazeera and Vice and stuff like that. I had always wanted to be, it was my lifelong dream to be, I'm not saying Kate Eady, but it was my lifelong dream to be a journalist and just be standing there with a microphone in my hand or have my name on the front page of a newspaper telling a story, telling people what's happening.
It's funny, isn't it, Leona? We're a similar age and I remember seeing Kate Eady reporting from many of the scenes that you've just described there and thinking, I think I actually did want to be her, to be honest. But, you know, it's just kind of seeing the stories and the excitement and kind of being in that first kind of row of history, really fascinating. And I think perhaps the general populace doesn't necessarily see the other side of that. I mean, you've spent a lot of time working on that other side. You've got a book coming out this year called Breaking Trauma in the Newsroom, co-edited with the BBC's Chris Lindsay, where journalists speak in it about how their work has impacted their mental health. You know, from all your experiences in the journalism you've done and then speaking with all these fellow colleagues, what did you take away from putting the book together?
Yeah, journalism can break you, ultimately. Not everyone, of course, has the same experiences. That book came from an experience I had 3 years ago now when I was at a riot. I was covering a riot in Derry. And dissident Republicans fired a gun up the street at the crowd gathered, obviously, at us. Bullets were whizzing past my head and one of them hit Lyra McKee and killed Lyra McKee. So she was there beside me and we tried to help her and, you know, my friend put his coat under her head and stuff and I phoned an ambulance and it was just really, really chaotic scenes. Really traumatic to see someone die at your feet. And then the aftermath of that, I suppose I was targeted by conspiracy theorists and horrible malicious people who kind of compounded my trauma in various different ways, threats and intimidation and stuff. And I felt very alone at that time, thinking this is an experience that has happened only to me. But it was a strange thing where I got talking to other journalists because I suppose in a way we're a big tribe. Journalists are a big tribe, and other people don't really get what happens in our work at times. That's not a normal thing to happen in anybody's work, not even a journalist's work, you know, that night. But still, other people were coming to me and saying, I know you're hurting, journalists, I know you're hurting. I have had a similar experience, not with something as dramatic, but with something. I covered an inquest and it really impacted me. Or I covered a murder scene and it really impacted me. And I just thought, there are so many people, journalists, who are impacted by negative experiences and are really hurting, and nobody's talking about it. So I started collecting some stories, and they were just, you know, they're not all I witnessed someone being murdered, or I was blown up, or I was shot at. There are some stories like that in the book. But there were other stories, like I covered a murder inquest of a woman who was similar age to me, and it was so traumatic that I left journalism. Or I covered an inquest or a murder scene where a child had been murdered, and that really impacted me because my child was the same age. Just really ordinary things. And even so much as, and people who work in local newspapers particularly will understand this, the grim conveyor belt of doom daily, grinding you down, like almost like a Brillo pad to your soul, and being impacted by that. And then having people in the newsroom, perhaps all over the UK, probably all over the world, tell you, you're a hard-nosed reporter, you should not be impacted by this. You should be tough, you should keep going. Forget about it, it's only a story. You're not part of the story, just move on. So I thought that it was really important to gather those stories together and show journalists all over, because I teach young journalists now, I'm putting them out into the field, and I wanted them to know that it's okay, we're not robots, as you said there. We're not robots, we're human beings, and things impact on us. And it's okay for them to impact on us, and it's okay to ask for help. It's not like that now in many newsrooms, where people are just expected to get on with it, and it's not right, shouldn't happen.
I think, you know, from our conversations with other journalists, there's this real sense, and I know that you and I have spoken quite a lot on Twitter, for instance, Leona, about this sense that actually we're supposed to maintain this stuff up a lip, that actually vulnerability is often regarded as a weakness, when actually I strongly believe, and you've written about this, that vulnerability can be reframed as a strength. It must have been so difficult, though, going through what you went through, but then also it's really humbling to hear how you've turned that into supporting other folks and creating space to hear their stories. I mean, I know that when I went through some of my mental health experiences of post-traumatic stress, I felt very alone. I felt like I was the only person in the world to have this experience. And it was so extraordinary then to be able to hear from others who had been going through similar things. So I guess this is me saying thank you for the fabulous work that you're doing, because it will make a difference. And particularly in the communities that you work within, where often you're covering not just any old story, but a story that is so closely entwined within your kind of identity and your local community. How do you find that impacts people as well?
Yeah, as I was saying, you know, when you're working on such a small beat, I'm based here in Derry in Northern Ireland, so I think the population is something a couple of 100,000, I can't remember what it is, 300,000 or something. And I find this when I'm talking to local journalists and they're covering a small beat like that, they're members of the community that they're actually reporting on as well. And that can be good in some ways, but also very problematic, because if you're reporting from perhaps, say for example, you're reporting court stories, and then you're going to the supermarket and you're seeing the relatives of the person that you've written a story about last week. And I know some journalists have been attacked in sort of local communities because people were angry about things that they've covered. So there's covering of the story, which sometimes if it's, say for example, I covered a story, there was a death, it was a murder of a young person, and from my community, it wasn't that far from my home, and the relatives were there, were obviously out covering. Myself and another couple of journalists have to cover the scene if it's, you know, there are police everywhere and we have to cover it, and we try and do it very discreetly and delicately and obviously with compassion. But when people are angry and they lash out, and then you're seeing those same people a week later, perhaps leaving your child to school, and they see you as a journalist, or they see you as an enemy, or they see you as a vulture who's trying to encroach on their grief, when you're not, you're just trying to do your job. I found a lot of local journalists had those type of problems, and they perhaps didn't want to talk about it in a book, but they just talked to me myself, that They were dealing with the problems with covering the grim conveyor belt of doom, as I said, you know, the murders or perhaps the court cases or the inquests or the tragic stories. Then they also had the hostility of their community. You know, why are you covering these things? Why have you put a story about my friend or whatever in the paper? And it was all consuming, suffocating almost pressure on journalists, and particularly in local, covering a local beat. And yet there was no help for them. They're just, as I say, just get on with it. This is your job. You shouldn't be affected by this. You shouldn't be impacted on this. Get on to the next story. And that's very much the ethos in a lot of newsrooms. Just get on to the next. No time to process anything. So you might be going out to a rally or a march or something and getting abuse at it or getting hassle at it, and then coming back, filing your story, and then you're given another story to do. Just go on out. No time to process it at all. So I think there were a lot of people like me covering sort of local beats or living in the community that you're covering and finding that very, very difficult. I find it very difficult. Obviously, someone was murdered in front of me. Obviously, the people who support that person who murdered the person lived in my city. I don't know who they were. They could be walking past me in the street, for all I know. They could be at my supermarket and stuff. And that was very difficult for me, actually, getting abuse online on social media and then not knowing who the people were. They were anonymous.
You were speaking there about being personally impacted by the stories in the local community. And you've spoken before how you feel that you narrowly escaped with your life on that night. And then in the months following Lyra's death, as you were trying to figure that out yourself personally, you were subjected to horrific attacks online. How did that impact you and your mental health?
It had a huge impact, not only on my mental health, but also on my family's mental health. Social media is so public. And when there are people, you know, threatening to kill you on social media, my kids were reading that, my older boys in particular, my teenagers, and that had a huge impact on them. It was horrific. I'm not going to lie, John. It was horrific. It was the worst period of my entire life. You know, not many people, I suppose, have to deal with the trauma of seeing someone murdered in front of your eyes, bullets missing your own head by centimeters. It felt like they were whizzing past. I don't know what the distance was. To see someone die at your feet and feel helpless, that's a really awful feeling as well. Feeling completely helpless, doing what you can. But I'm not a medical person. I you know, you're standing there, you don't know what to do when someone is hurt, injured in front of you, so badly injured in front of you. And trying to deal with that, I don't know how I dealt with it, to be honest with you. I feel like I'm a different person now than I was then. I really went through hell. What happened was, because I was there at the night recording for the various news outlets I was working for, I recorded videos of the riots beforehand and the police, you know, doing their operations or whatever beforehand. And then I stopped at a point when Lear was shot. I obviously didn't film. I was using my phone to phone an ambulance. But I had these conspiracy theorists saying that because Nancy Pelosi was there that day and I had interviewed her in the morning, and because I was standing beside Lear McKee that night, that it was somehow connected with the Illuminati, and that I was in the Illuminati, and that I had her murdered for some kind of sacrifice to Nancy Pelosi. It's complete wired to the moon lunacy. But people were sharing this online, and then people were saying then that it was a false flag, you know, the usual sort of stuff from conspiracy theories, that it was a false flag and that I was hiding Lyra and that we were all actors. And this went worldwide, and there were millions of shares on some of these YouTube channels. Then the people from the YouTube channels obviously found my social media platforms, and they started bombarding me. They said that I should be killed like Lyra was killed. I should be arrested. They were coming to my house to burn it down. They were going to kill my children. They were going to kill me, that I was the scum of the earth. And this was every time I put on social media. This was, I mean, thousands and thousands of comments underneath with me tagged in. You go on, you check your notifications, and you might have maybe 10, thousands every day. And then people started making, these conspiracy theorists started making videos, YouTube videos. There was one very famous one in Canada. I think she's been shut down at this stage, but she made these really hurtful videos that, you know, obviously I didn't know Lyra that well. Her family would have been very hurt by these too. And then, of course, local people kind of tapped into it too, perhaps people that didn't like journalists or whatever, and also the people that were supporters of the people who murdered Lyra. It was horrific. It was a horrific time in my life. And then, you know, they put graffiti on the wall about me that I was a tout, which is a thing here in Northern Ireland that kind of is associated with people who tell the police what happened in certain situations. For example, murders, if they give a statement or what have you, or if they work with the police in any way to catch any kind of killers or anything like that, they're branded a tout. So that kind of stuff went up on the walls about me. It was really, really suffocating. It was so bad, I didn't want to go out of the house. There were hundreds of people from my own area, you know, Northern Ireland, who were writing really awful things about me online as well, and that I would do anything for a story, and that I was lying, that I wasn't really there, that I was just saying I was there to improve my profile on social media. It was just horrendous, and I just felt that the world hated me. I was being sent death threats. I talked about this online, so I said, I'm feeling really bad here. I'm really, really struggling. So then there were other people from Northern Ireland who perhaps supported the people who killed Lyra, who would send me emails asking me how my PTSD was and have I killed myself yet. I felt the person staring at me in the supermarket queue was the person who had, you know, maybe a day or two beforehand had said that he was going to drag me out of my car and beat me up if I came back into the likes of these different communities that I came from. So it was hard to be a journalist then, but I kept going. It was really, really suffocating. It impacted my family so bad. We wanted to just move house. We wanted to move away, actually, from here.
Just listening to you talk there, Leona, it's that sense of, you know, you've experienced such significant trauma witnessing what you did when Lyra was killed. And then it's been exacerbated by online harassment, something that we didn't have until a decade ago. And actually, it's been getting significantly worse. You and I, again, we've had kind of chats online, ironically, I suppose, about this. But one of the things I'm struggling with at the moment is the fact that online harassment is still not taken seriously enough. And I'm really interested to hear what your sense of that is, because that has increased massive amounts the trauma that you've experienced, right? How do we get people to take it more seriously?
It has increased. And I often said, if I had more money, I would sue some social media platforms, because the harassment that came through some of those platforms was just shocking. You know, I had reported people for saying that they were going to stab me, or that they were, you know, saying really, really horrible things, and nothing was ever done about it.
Isn't this correct that you were asked what you'd done to change the situation, as though it was incumbent on you to make amends for things, rather than the platforms coming about and saying, we're going to change this? Because often people, and I don't know if this is a situation for you, often people who experience that online harm are actually kind of blamed. They're like blamed for this. And they're said, well, actually, it's up to you to change the situation. But that's not the case, is it? That shouldn't be the case.
No, it shouldn't be the case. I suppose not the social media platforms. You don't really get to speak to a human being often. So you're sort of, you're emailing a bot, screen grabs of people saying that they're going to slit your throat, or that they're going to do this, they're going to do that. And then you get an email back, perhaps maybe 3 weeks later, to say that it didn't breach the rules or what have you. So I never really spoke to a human being about anything like that. I went to the police about plenty of the abuse, and they also said that it was social media and online is a very grey area that they don't have power over. So, you know, it's kind of up to yourself if you want to take a civil suit against this. What did happen was, there was one particular person online who had set up a blog. This was just one of many people who were harassing me online. Set up a blog talking about coming to my house. He set up a GoFundMe page to buy weapons to attack my house. And what I thought was really strange was he actually raised £257, people donating money for it. And that really upset me. You know, it wasn't just this one person who was being really abusive and horrible and toxic, but there were people actually donating money to him so he could buy weapons to attack my house. He would post pictures of him. He was coming to my house. He knew where I, well, the rough area where I live, you know, the city or whatever that I lived. And I went to the police about him, and they couldn't do anything because he was based across the border. What actually happened, the only way that I got that blog and his Facebook page, which he was spreading so much hate and getting so much support for, even locally in my own town, getting support, which made me quite nervous, was I went to the social media platforms about him. They said he didn't break any rules. I went to my friend in The Guardian, my journalist friend in The Guardian. They did a story about it. And that was the only way that that was taken down. It was because the pressure was put on by fellow journalists. And that was how it was taken down. So it wasn't the social media platforms that did it. It was actually journalist friends who saw what I was going through, yeah.
So do you think the solution... Again, it's that tricky one in terms of, you know, the people who incur the horrors are made to kind of come up with the responsibilities or solutions for it. But do you think there's an element of kind of the news industry needing to do more to address the scourge of online harassment, particularly against those whose voices have already long been marginalised in the media, right?
Yeah, I think they do. The social media platforms certainly have to do more. I mean, I know that Rebecca Whittington is doing fantastic work dealing with online harassment in Reach PLC. So she's doing really good work. I think that people like you, Hannah, are really, and John as well, and Headlines, really amplifying this so, so well that people are sort of thinking, now we need to do something about this. Our journalists need to be strong and to thrive. If anybody has been experienced a pylon, it's horrific. It's absolutely horrific. And I could probably guarantee you that no journalist working today hasn't been hit by something like that at some stage. I remember saying something about it was a young court reporter. She was maybe about 23. It's somewhere like Birmingham or Manchester. She'd done a court report, very simple court report. And underneath the story that they had put online, there were hundreds of comments about her being a terrible journalist, about even comments about her personal appearance, how she was stupid, how just horrible, horrible stuff. The girl is just doing her job. News outlets are not doing something about that. They need to, because it definitely does have an impact on people. People might not have the experience that I have had. And it's a very unique, and I don't want to put people off journalism or anything like that, but it's a very unique, maybe once in a lifetime experience for someone. And I don't think any of us working in the media have escaped that. It's just, it's kind of almost normal now that journalists, if they put their stories online, they get abuse about it. You know, when you're listening, when you're looking, at all these different comments that are so derogatory, so fierce and vicious against you, that can really get you down. We're only human, and that can really get you down. And you need someone there to kind of put their arm around you and say, listen, you've done a great job. These people are just idiots. They don't know what they're talking about, and you're doing fantastically well. Keep going.
Validate what you're doing.
Yeah.
I mean, validate your experiences.
Yeah.
I think that point about human is just so important. I mean, as we said at the start, we're not robots. We are human. This abnormality has been normalised, right? It's been normalised, and actually to the extent that, you know, I'm doing separate work with some folks around the world on this, and we're saying that it's not okay. It's not okay to attack journalists. It's not okay to assume that online harassment should be part of the job. And I think that where perhaps one of the things that's super important in this space is how it intersects with physical safety, how the kind of threats online can blur into people's physical safety space. And I know, John, that you had a question that you wanted to ask Leona about in that regard.
You mentioned there, Leona, that one individual wanted to raise money to attack you. That I just can't even comprehend that happening to me. But has Lyra's death made you rethink your own personal safety, especially while covering unrest? What steps do you take now if you're going out and about?
It did make me reevaluate my own safety measures at home, John, more than anything else. Because I was getting so many threats, I had to put extra security in my home. I had to carry a personal safety alarm that the police gave me, because people were posting pictures of my work, and we know you work here, we know you go here, we know you socialise here. One person actually posted a photograph of me in a coffee shop. I was sitting by myself, and he had been sitting behind me, and he posted a photograph. He didn't tell me who he was. Obviously, he was anonymous. So I used to carry, still do carry, a personal safety alarm that were given me by the police. My children, my two older boys as well, I give them personal safety alarms also, because people were giving them grief as well. My older boys, they were giving them grief in the street. My boys would go out socialising, and people would start arguments with them about their mum. It was horrific. I wouldn't say that after Lyra was murdered that I changed my safety, you know, routine when I'm going to cover unrest in the street. I always did the same thing. You know, you hug close to the wall, you take cover, you take hard cover, you watch what the police are doing, and if they're in their vehicles and if they're taking, you know, hard cover, you take hard cover. You very much, if there is shooting or if there's a chance of shooting, you know, you get down beside the wheel of a vehicle and you take cover, and just watching the entire, almost like the Terminator, watching the scene, the environment, you know, if it's getting too hostile, you get out. It's, you know, there are all those different things there. I wouldn't say that anything like that has changed. What I do now that is, I suppose, different is that I really impress upon my students the importance of that safety. I'm not out on the beat anymore. I had to leave the streets because of what happened. I had to leave my job that I had dreamt of since I was a little girl because of what happened. So I had to put all that work that I built up over the years, I had to just basically burn it to the ground and start again as a university lecturer. But I teach my students that their safety is their responsibility. They can't be dependent on anyone else, and they have to take it seriously. We have a thing in Northern Ireland, an attitude, I suppose, in Northern Ireland that I'm also trying to change, that is very flippant about safety. Journalists are quite flippant about safety over here, perhaps because of what we've been through this last 30 years. You know, we're used to this level of threat. We're used to riots. It doesn't faze us to go to riots, where maybe a journalist on the beat in Birmingham, it might be a strange occurrence. It's not here. So I would see things like, you know, I would be out at covering a riot or what have you, and I would see a journalist perhaps coming from Al Jazeera or someone coming from Spain, and they would have a flak jacket on, they would have a hard hat on, they would have protective things on their knees and their legs and stuff. And then there'd be a journalist standing beside them from Belfast, perhaps, wearing a t-shirt and a baseball cap. It never really seemed strange to me, I suppose, until Lyra was murdered, that we kind of don't take our self-preservation, our security, our safety as seriously as other people. We have a high level of threat here in Northern Ireland, and nobody really reacts to it. So I've been trying to push that in Northern Ireland in particular. You know, whenever you're going out to a riot, wear a flak jacket. It doesn't have to be a big, bulky flak jacket that perhaps makes you look like a police officer, and therefore in Northern Ireland context, you look like a target, you know, because often these people shoot at police officers. So you can buy thinner flak jackets, or modern technology has allowed us that, and get a hard hat that, you know, that workmen wear, and wear that at it.
So it's kind of impressing on them the kind of the basic safety awareness that perhaps they've missed out on because of the nature of what's gone on in Northern Ireland for the last several decades. But I guess the other thing I was going to ask you was, you know, what's the reaction been when you say to young people that? Because often we get this sense that people perhaps feel that they're invincible, right? And I guess the other thing is, the physical safety is one thing, right? But it's very closely aligned with the mental safety too, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And it's talking to young journalists about their safety. They are, you know, we're invincible. That's not going to happen to us. Talking to the older journalists, it's exactly the same. We're invincible. That's not going to happen to us. And I've had quite a bit of pushback about, you should be wearing a flak jacket at a riot. You know, there's a guy, a police officer standing beside you dressed like RoboCop, and you're standing there in your t-shirt and your baseball cap. There's pushback. There's a kind of attitude, a very strange attitude. But yeah, mental resilience. I teach a class specifically, you know, in that area to my guys. And all my guys that are going out into the field now have been through that sort of resilience training. I talk about what happened to me, myself. I sort of show my vulnerability to them, and that, you know, and it's okay to be vulnerable. So there's this new band of journalists going out there that have this more in mind. And by the way, inspired by things that Hannah, you and John are doing with Headlines, and really opening up that conversation. I direct them to your website, and I get them to listen to the podcast. And these big, big, well-known journalists talking about their mental health, I don't know if you do understand the impact that has on people. Whenever people are talking about that so openly, being so open about their own struggles, how it helps them think, well, you know, if I have these struggles, it's okay to have these struggles, because look who these other people are that had them, and they're big, big, big names, and they've also been impacted by stories. So it's okay for me to be impacted by it too. I'll go and get help because this is normal. Yeah, so it's really, really important, I think, to teach the young journalists about mental health safety, the, you know, preparing themselves for the daily grind and ways to kind of counteract that.
Leona, thank you so much for the shout out, and you'll be able to direct them to your own podcast here with us. Let's broaden the questions out a little bit. From the outside looking in, Northern Ireland is always seen through the prism of the Troubles, and I've been there many times. My mum comes from County Fermanagh, so I know a lot about the cliches that people come up with around Northern Ireland. But in terms of reshaping that narrative and overturning some of those prejudices that people may have, what's your message to young students?
About turning over the prejudice about, yeah. You know, I suppose the younger generation haven't got the baggage that we would have, you know, with regards to Northern Ireland and the Troubles, and they look at old footage of maybe their street from years back and it's on fire and it's so alien to them, and that's fantastic. That's absolutely fantastic. But at the same time, they're going into a different Northern Ireland where the war was on the streets and it's now on social media. It seems Northern Ireland's social media is so vicious, and Brexit has caused a shift change, I think, in Northern Ireland, where people are more fierce about their identity. It's almost like communities are a wee bit more divided than they were a couple of years back. They were obviously very divided during the Troubles, whenever people were killing one another, but now we've moved into this kind of different arena where battles are fought on social media and sometimes they spill over. We still have our problems here in Northern Ireland. We have bonfires every single year, which my journalists are covering now, which I covered 25 years ago, which a journalist before me was covering, I don't know, 50 years ago. We don't seem to change an awful lot here in Northern Ireland, so the guys here are going to be covering the same stuff that perhaps I did back in the day. And, you know, bonfires, we have our marching season, we have our arguments over British and Irishness, we have our arguments over flags and identity and all those types of things. So it's taken some of the heat out of it, certainly. But I think it was a couple of years back, Northern Ireland was considered one of the most dangerous places to be a journalist. One of the most, obviously, there are other places too, but, you know, with regards getting threats from paramilitaries, some of the guys that are coming through my courses now will still be facing that. They'll still be facing intimidation and harassment from organisations, criminal organisations that don't want their stories to be told. They'll be covering court cases that perhaps will get them abuse. You know, they're going into a different Northern Ireland for sure, and they're putting out stories about how beautiful this place is and about how, you know, the Game of Thrones, how successful that is. And there's a different tone to the news for sure, but there's still that underbelly of maliciousness that it will remain.
But programmes like Derry Girls have changed the narrative, haven't they, as well? It's set in the 90s, very much set in the Troubles, but it really shows a different side to Northern Ireland, doesn't it?
Yeah, it has. It's such a fun show. It had its serious points as well, but I wrote a piece actually in the Radio Times about this, about how Derry Girls kind of showed a different side to us. That side was always here in Northern Ireland, you know, the fact that there was all this stuff happening on the streets, but normal life was going on sort of alongside that. So it was kind of, that's the way it's always been here. That's the way it always will be here. But it's just people looking from outside in will see Derry Girls, they'll see Game of Thrones, they'll see different things, and they'll think, oh, these guys are doing really well. But that's the way it's always been. It's just that other people are getting eyes on it now.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the other aspects of Leona O'Neill. You are a fiction writer as well. And, you know, I was really thrilled to read about that because I wrote fiction too. And I found that fiction's been really helpful in kind of helping me as a catharsis, kind of write out my experiences in a different kind of way. Tell us about the fiction book that's going to be coming out in 2024, which seems like a long time away, but that's how fiction works, isn't it?
Yeah. So it's a book, it's called Perdition Street. And I started writing it in lockdown. Lockdown was so difficult for me because I went through all that trauma, and to deal with it, a lot of people do alcohol, maybe do drugs or whatever, workaholics. I was a workaholic, and I threw every single day, 24/7, into my work so that I didn't have to think about that dark night in Craigan and everything that went on afterwards. So when lockdown happened, it was kind of, right, everything stops. And I thought, flip, this isn't good for me. And I really, really struggled. I had to think about things. I had to process things. And I found it so, so difficult. So I started writing this book called Perdition Street. And it's about a private detective who's from Dublin. And he binds the souls of the murdered to those who murdered them. So, you know, I was dealing with a lot of demons, I suppose, at the time. And Atlas Bishop was a way to exorcise those for me. Dead people, spirits kind of show up to him, and he has to bind their souls to the person that murdered them. And then the person kind of screams in their ear, tortures them, whatever, to death. Basically, one goes to hell, the other one goes to heaven. It's really dark stuff, and I don't know where it came from, but other, you know, obviously being a journalist in Northern Ireland for 24 years and seeing so many people's families deal with the, you know, the death, the murder of their loved one, and no one ever is held accountable for it, I think that's where it came from. And perhaps my own kind of, I don't want to say hate, my own sort of feelings over people who murder people getting away scot-free with it, it just sort of, it really irked me. So it was a way to exorcise my demons. And it's not all dark and grim, and there are some really funny parts in it as well. And it's kind of, it's a bit quirky, it's a bit on a, he's a bit of a John Wick character crossed with, I don't know, quite vicious and violent, but he's also, he has really bad anxiety. He struggles with a lot of stuff himself because he lives with a ghost of his dead mother. His father murdered his mother whenever he was young, and so her ghost kind of hangs around all the time. He wants to bind her to his father, and he can't find them.
Wow. What a way to exercise your demons, as it were. I'm really glad you mentioned the lockdown aspect, because I think that for a lot of people, and the trauma that you experienced prior to lockdown was really significant, and we're not comparing you with anybody else, but that's such a kind of important way to say lockdown had an impact on people, and this is how I found my way through. Is it the idea it's going to be a series?
Yeah, it's going to be a series. Yeah. I mean, there are some really exciting things happening about it, and talks with various people about TV shows and stuff like that, but it's very early kind of stages, and it might not come to anything. But I mean, it would transfer very well into a film or a TV series, so it's fingers crossed and all that. But it was so therapeutic to write it, as you said, Hannah. Fiction is, you know, you're taking yourself out of it, but you're putting some of yourself into it, but, you know, how much you put into it, nobody knows except you. So I give my main character really bad anxiety and panic attacks, and I was able to talk about those very authentically because, you know, that I have really bad anxiety and panic attacks too. So I was able to say, this guy, obviously I wouldn't be a violent person by any, I have to get my husband to come in and remove spiders from the room. I wouldn't be violent at all. But, you know, I was able to give him some sort of authentic qualities that were maybe borrowed from me, the anxiety for sure and the panic attacks, and the kind of building yourself back up after, you know, trauma and stuff like that too. So I was able to try and give him some of those.
Talking about your writing being a therapeutic experience, we actually ask all our guests if they'd share one piece of advice to our listeners that helps them manage their mental health. What would yours be?
Realize that you're not a robot. I think the first thing that anybody should really do is recognize that there's something not right and try and deal with that. Face what it is. Feel all your emotions. Try and, even if they're really bad, you know, sometimes facing them head on helps. What helps me is, and it won't help everybody else, it just helps me personally. I know Hannah's big into running, and she inspired me too, also to get kind of, you know, get the fitness going. And I wouldn't be out running the streets or the hills and the dales like Hannah. I do yoga. Yoga really helps me, and I suppose, and meditation, and sort of centering yourself. I think you have to really go into yourself whenever you're dealing with this stuff. You know, if you're dealing with trauma or you're dealing with anything, you have to really go into yourself and kind of face that fear. That's what happened whenever I was in, you know, on lockdown. I got sick. I got suspected COVID, and I was in bed for 2 weeks on my own in my room, by myself, with all these kind of horrible memories and stuff. And I just had to face them. I just had to face them head on. So yeah, my advice is to just face things. Don't run away from what's hurting you. You know, you can't run away forever. Just stand your ground and look at it in the eye and see what you can do to kind of lessen that. Use yoga, meditation, running, whatever, all those healthy things that you can kind of look at. Don't go to alcohol, don't go to drugs, don't go to the workaholic kind of side of things. It doesn't work. It just wears you into the ground eventually, and it will get better. It can't last forever.
Leona, look, it's been absolutely brilliant hearing from you, and you really are a role model for people in terms of sharing your experiences, having been through so much. We're extremely grateful to you. We began this conversation by talking about how you got into journalism. So we'd like to end this conversation by asking you why journalism matters. It's a question we ask all of our guests. Why does journalism matter, and particularly now?
Journalism is so important. When you're a journalist, you can fight on behalf of your city, your community, your country. You can take on governments. You can make change happen. When I was a journalist, you know, myself and another few journalists made the government change their ways with regards to cancer drugs and give a young mother 2 or 3 years extra life because, you know, the pressure that we put on people. Journalism gives a voice to the voiceless. And journalism is the most exciting job in the world. You're sitting there, you have a front seat when history is unfolding in front of your eyes. Nobody else gets to do that. You know, when I have a lot of friends that are journalists, and if I ask them, you know, would you do anything else? Would you be an accountant? Would you work in a bank? No way. Journalism makes you feel so alive when you're doing it. You can do really, really good things with it. It's so important to get to the truth. And even more important these days when there's a lot of people who are fighting back, pushing back on that sort of truth. They put out their own quote-unquote alternative facts. Journalism is now more important than ever to get the real truth out there. So keep being journalists, keep doing it.
Leona, thank you so much. And I think, you know, with advice like that to the new journalists of tomorrow that you speak with, I think we've got a bright future ahead of us. So thank you. What a powerful story from Leona, and it's so important to hear people's experiences like hers, to help other journalists know that they're not isolated, that they're not alone, John.
And from such a horrendous experience, Hannah, how she's managed to channel that so positively. And the big takeaway for me from what she said was, don't run away from the challenges in life. Stand and face what it is and look it in the eye, and it will get better.
We're very grateful to Leona and all our podcast guests for sharing their experiences and for helping us try to normalise conversations around mental health in journalism. Please keep on listening, and please check out our other podcasts that you may have missed, Behind the Headlines with Headlines Network, on all the usual channels.